Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Students across the country, including here in the First State, are expected to hold a school walkout next week, advocating for more action to curb gun violence in the wake of last month's school shooting in Florida.
The students I've talked to, they're expecting a strong turnout. They know that support for their position is not necessarily unanimous. Likelihood is that participation is going to be stronger at schools where the principal or the headmaster has been supportive.
Contributor Larry Nagengast has more on his piece about how this walkout may play out here in the First State. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also introduce you to a new political podcast from the University of Delaware, focused on this year's midterm election, and meet the winner of this year's State Poetry Out Loud contest. Plus, look at how Delaware is working to help better understand the American eel. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Gun violence, gun control, and school safety became major issues of debate nationally once again following last month's killing of 17 students and staff members at a high school in Parkland, Florida. And this renewed debate has specifically engaged students across the country, led by a number of the students that survived the shooting in Florida. Just how engaged are these student activists? The first indication will likely come Wednesday, the one-month anniversary of the Florida shootings. That's when the National School Walkout is planned, a coordinated campaign that has students nationally walk out of their schools at 10 a.m. for 17 minutes, 1 minute in memory of each of the Parkland victims, to advocate for an end to gun violence. Contributor Larry Nagengast checked in with schools around the First State to see who intends to participate locally and how school and district administrators plan to respond. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to tell me what he found.
Well, let's start with the basics. About how many school walkouts are anticipated locally?
I'm not aware of anyone who has actually polled individual schools throughout the state, so any listing that you see or know about is likely to be incomplete. The largest list that I've seen, which is on the News Journal's website, and coupling that with some other reports, it appears that students will be participating at 22 high schools and one elementary school, and perhaps more than that, plus a group at the University of Delaware. I think the final numbers are going to be greater than that because it's very likely that at some schools walkouts will occur, but the students have been keeping quiet about it because they're concerned about tipping off administrators who just might not be supportive of their activity.
But you have had the chance to talk to some students that are involved in planned walkouts. What are they saying, and what are their expectations for what's going to happen next week?
Well, I think the students I've talked to, they're expecting a strong turnout. Now, I'm not quite sure what the definition of strong might be. They know that support for their position is not necessarily unanimous. Likelihood is that participation is going to be stronger at schools where the principal or the headmaster has been supportive of the students' ideas and suggestions. Students do have a diversity of views. Emma McTurk, who's a student organizer at Concord High School, says her classmates tend to support restricting access to automatic and semi-automatic weapons, keeping guns out of the hands of people with mental health issues, better background checks, improve school security. But that doesn't mean that everyone in the student body supports all of those proposals. And as for the walkout itself, the students expect it to be orderly, to be dignified, respectful. School officials, to the extent that they are involved, are doing what they can to ensure that it does turn out that way.
I was going to say, it seems from your piece that most schools seem inclined to work with students rather than try to shut them down. Why is that? What are they saying about how they intend to respond next week?
Well, you know, there are several factors in play here. First, many schools are encouraging civic activism among their students. That's part of their philosophy. You know, if they want seniors and graduates to go out and vote in November, to become involved in their communities, they would be inconsistent if they told students they couldn't express their views on the biggest issue to confront their generation. Another administrator from Salesianum School phrased it a little differently. He said, in essence, if you tell a group of teenagers that they can't do something, they're more likely to go out and defy you and do it anyway. And third, this is a national issue with objectives that everyone seems to understand. It's not a local controversy between the students and the administration over dress codes or discipline policies, something like that, where the attitudes on both sides would tend to harden. Now, there is a more subtle issue here, too, one which has school leaders carefully choosing their words when discussing schools that are likely to take different positions here. If a school clamps down on student expression on this issue, some people just might get the impression that the administration tacitly supports the status quo with regard to either access to firearms or to school safety. You know, and whether or not that's true, in some circles it would not be good to have your school perceived in that fashion.
Now, one place there was some initial resistance was in the Cesar Rodney School District. Can you walk us through what happened there and where things stand right now?
Okay, well, in a nutshell, the district superintendent put out a statement saying that he could not support having students, quote, disrupt the educational setting, unquote, by walking out. He also said that teachers would not be permitted to walk out. That prompted a controversy on the school district's Facebook page, with students and some adults criticizing the superintendent's position. Then the school district's communications officer, who manages the Facebook page, deleted comments that criticized the superintendent while letting favorable comments remain on the page. Now, it's not totally clear how this issue is going to be resolved. Some Cesar Rodney High School students are planning to walk out. Will the school stop them? Will the school discipline them? There have been some subtle indications that the school's attitude is a little less harsh now than it might have been a week or so ago, but we're really not going to know for sure until next week.
Which brings me to one other thing that seemed evident in your piece, and that's that school administrators, when they're talking about their concerns about these walkouts, the primary concern seems to be safety. You know, where are the students going to walk out, go to? If teachers join them, what do the students who stay behind do? But it seems that there's been enough time and engagement at many of these schools to kind of work those things out. Is that about right? And might it be a different story if students had kind of just picked a random day and walked out unannounced?
I think you're really right about that, Tom. And that's why the administrators who have been acknowledging students' First Amendment rights to express their views are working with them to make sure that the activity occurs smoothly. These schools are making arrangements so students gather in a safe place with staff members observing. And many will be asking students who don't participate to gather in a large location indoors, like the cafeteria, the auditorium, the gym, where some other staff members can supervise while there's activity going on outside. The fact that students and school staff are working together rather than springing a surprise increases the likelihood that all will turn out well.
And it may also really improve the effectiveness of the walkout itself if it is deemed as orderly and people focus more on the point they're trying to make rather than the process of what they're doing.
No, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, the principal at Brandywine High School, for instance, mentioned to me that, with fire drills and things like that, they know how to get students out of the building and get them located in safe places on the school grounds. And they are intending to work with the students at Brandywine so that as they file out the building and go to wherever they are deciding to congregate, all of that runs smoothly. So if they're working together, and in essence, the school administration is helping the student body, showing them in many respects how to do it the right way.
You hit on a couple of other issues in your piece. One is that some of these student-driven efforts are going beyond this planned walkout. Can you share some of the other things that are going on with students as they try to make their voices heard on this issue?
Well, certainly those of us who follow politics hear a lot of people wishing for bipartisanship these days. Bessie Spears, who's the head of school at Tower Hill School, was pleased that this week the school's young Democrats and young Republicans were organizing a teach-in on gun violence. So both sides there are talking together about the issue. At Concord High School, the students there, besides planning the walkout for next week, they set up a GoFundMe page and they raised $5,500 so that they could charter two buses for more than 100 students and staff and parents to participate in the March for Our Lives demonstration in Washington, D.C. on March 24th.
You also noted that there also seems to be maybe some more student angst about school safety these days. And these feelings are really kind of, you know, running deep for a lot of students, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, of course, what we're hearing at this point, it's a little disjointed, somewhat anecdotal. But for instance, Brandywine's principal told me about a boy who was known as a tough kid in school, and he asked his teacher to make sure that the classroom door was locked. A little bit surprising behavior, both the principal and the teacher thought. A Concord student 2 weeks ago told school officials that he had seen a posting on Snapchat, and it said words to the effect of, "I'm going to do better than the Florida kid at Concord High School." Well, that post got checked out, and it turned out that the threat was directed at a Concord High School, but the school was in Concord, New Hampshire. More generally, students appear to be paying more attention to things that they seldom worried about before, like making sure that the side entrances and the exit doors are locked, a lot of the other little things that go into making the school a safer, more secure environment. In the past, this was things that, certainly if you went back 5, 10 years, students didn't worry about this a whole lot. No big deal to leave the door open, let somebody come in the other way rather than check in through the front office. They're being a lot more careful about that now than they used to be.
Also, for a companion piece you did for us, you checked in with some 60s-era activists to get their take on this generation's student activism, and they seemed impressed. Why?
Well, I talked to George Wolkind, who was a leader of anti-war protests at the University of Delaware in the 60s, and to Bill Hutchison, who's a retired teacher who reluctantly served in Vietnam and later protested against the first Persian Gulf War by remaining seated in his classroom while students recited the Pledge of Allegiance. They noticed a couple of things. One is that today's adults, having endured Vietnam and Watergate and 9/11 and its aftermath, there seem to be more understanding of students' rights of self-expression than adults in their generation, in their era, were. And they also noted that the eloquence and the determination of the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School has galvanized the nation and earned them broad respect.
And there seems to be a kind of a prevailing sense that this version of student activism on this issue could have legs and last past the regular news cycle churn. Is that the sense you got talking to the various people you talked to for this piece?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I certainly got it from George Wolkind and Bill Hutchison, and from any number of school officials, who pointed out that this is the first big issue that many students of this era have gotten into. I mean, so today's teenagers, and I think the millennials as well, they're undaunted. They're pushing adults like us to solve problems that we haven't been able to solve for years. We haven't seen youth activism like this in a long while, probably not since Vietnam and the civil rights battles of the 60s. And I don't think these kids are going to quit until they accomplish their goals, or at least come very, very close to it.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. Again, his piece on how the national school walkout may play out locally next week is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. The Green continues in the moment with the debut of a new political podcast from the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. We'll have a sample of that new podcast for you next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We are getting ready for a midterm election later this year, and as part of our coverage, Delaware Public Media is once again partnering with the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication on Delaware Debates this October. They'll feature Delaware's candidates for U.S. Senate and U.S. House of Representatives. But we're not waiting until fall to start diving into election coverage. We're also working with the Center for Political Communication on a podcast connected to its upcoming national agenda series, Midterm Matters, that will delve into voter and civic engagement in the midterm election, campaign strategy, news coverage, and polling. The first episode of the Midterm Matters podcast was recorded this week on the UD campus in Newark with the Center for Political Communication Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, and Dr. David Redlosk, Chair of the UD Department of Political Science and International Relations. Here on The Green this week, we wanted to give you a taste of the podcast, bringing you a portion focused on local midterm election issues that we discussed. Check it out.
We'll start with the General Assembly, where so far six state lawmakers have officially said they are leaving at the end of this session. Another two are expected to do the same, and that group includes the Senate Majority Leader, Margaret Rose Henry, Senate Minority Leader, Gary Simpson, JFC Co-Chair, Melanie George Smith. So even if seats in those situations don't flip parties, there is the potential to have a fair number of new faces and some new leadership. How big a deal is that? Again, we're going back to the topic we talked about before, that midterm turnout is so low. This is an opportunity for some real change of tone in the state legislature.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's kind of reflecting what's happening on the national level. There does seem to be sort of a Trump effect that I think is happening at regional as well as national level, sort of a response to this very conservative populist movement. So even in a state like Delaware, I think that, you know, there's a response to that in terms of how people want to position themselves.
Well, I think it's approximately 10% of the state legislature that has step down or not running again, right? I don't know. I haven't been in Delaware long enough to know if that really sounds big or small, right? If people served an average of 10 years, you'd expect 10% a year to turn over. But in this case, regardless of whether this is a big or small number, the fact that top leaders are stepping down does make a difference, right? You lose a great deal of experience, and legislating is much more effective with experienced legislators than it is with inexperienced legislators. The experienced people kind of know how to do what needs to be done, and they know how to resist the pressures they ought to resist. So losing that kind of experience can be really problematic. Now, you know, presumably it gives other people the opportunity to step up at some point. The other thing worth noting is that the leaders of neither party likes open seats, right, if they're yours, right? Because open seats, you're at much more danger of losing than you are if your incumbent is running. Obviously, the opposite party loves open seats because you have a chance. Because it's a midterm election, turnout will be lower than it was in the presidential, even if it's higher than a normal midterm. You know, things happen in low turnout elections that you never expect. I remember there was a witch in Delaware sometime before I came here, right? The perfect example of what can happen in a low turnout primary.
It is definitely something worth watching. Also worth watching, one of the statewide elected offices, state auditor, Republicans suffering a bit of a blow there. The longtime state auditor, Tom Wagner, saying he's not going to run again due to health concerns. He had been in that office for nearly three decades, and until recently, the only Republican to have much success running statewide. And while Democrats have lined up to run for this spot, no Republican thus far has shown interest. It's still early, obviously, but this looks like a real opportunity for Democrats to flip a statewide office in their direction.
Yeah, it's kind of a, Delaware at this point is thought to be a relatively Democratic state. And so you would think the Democrats might have a leg up going into an open seat like this on a statewide election. But again, I will say what I've said earlier, which is, you know, people who are more conservative are more likely to turn out in off-year elections than people who are more liberal. So it might not be as imbalanced as it would have been in a general election, that is the turnout. And I would also add that the job of state auditor is one of those where people may simply think Republicans would be better at it, right? You're watching the money, you're watching how things happen, and Democrats just waste money and spend it. And, you know, can we really trust them to watch it? Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, Democrats certainly have a better chance than they would if there were an incumbent. But I don't think you necessarily write it off as a party flip.
Well, and it depends on if it rains or not, right?
And certainly Tom Wagner was able, as an incumbent, that people had kind of seen in that position, and a Republican, been able to hold that position. He had said he probably would have tried again, even with the health issues, if Ken Simpler had not gotten the treasurer's post and put another Republican in a statewide office. So it has been an interesting thing to keep an eye on, and we'll see if any Republicans, now that Tom Wagner has officially stepped out, will step in and see if they can find a way to win that office. to the Republican side once again. It's also a glut of Democrats running for attorney general, looking to replace Matt Dent, who has decided not to seek re-election. And again, on the Republican side right now, there's no candidates. Tom Neuberger had said, the Wilmington lawyer, that he was going to seek the office, but last week he said he is not going to run. He's pursuing some litigation that he says would keep him from running. So, again, it's an interesting situation for Republicans because, unlike, you know, maybe some of the lower level offices, this is one that they're not expected to sit out. They're going to have to find a candidate somewhere. And certainly they do not want to leave this relatively uncontested for Democrats.
No, you don't want to leave, quite frankly, you don't want to leave statewide offices uncontested, period, right? It's you need something, kind of an umbrella, to bring in your candidates. Obviously, in Delaware, there's also a statewide congressional election. But again, it's not clear that the Republicans can field a strong challenge there, so that, you know, as you're sitting here, if you're the GOP, thinking, we really need someone at the tops of the tickets so that we can rally everybody to them. It's a tough situation if they don't get that filled.
Speaking of the top of the tickets, the top of the ticket this time around would be the Senate race involving Tom Carper. He is facing a primary challenge this time around from the left, progressive activist Kerry Harris. There's also a pair of GOP challengers, at least there were, until Chuck Boyce suspended his campaign last week for health reasons. That leaves Wilmington businessman Gene Truano. Carper's elective track record obviously speaks for itself. So is it in any way informative that there seems to be a little bit more interest in challenging him this time around than there has been perhaps in other election cycles?
It's kind of a microcosm of what's happening at the national level, particularly seeing someone like Kerry Harris, who's would be the first biracial lesbian woman to serve in Congress, also having served as a U.S. Air Force veteran. I think we're seeing a lot of candidates that we typically wouldn't have seen in a pre-Trump, scenario. I think the other thing is that along with the retirements that we're seeing, there are a lot of baby boomers who are reaching this age who are, I think a lot of people are saying, you know, is that, you know, are they aging out of this position? Would they need to be replaced by younger, more, you know, excited energy to bring to the table. Now, I was just reading that. I guess Carper says he still runs 8 miles every day before church before church on every Sunday. But you know, he again typically votes along party lines. So with the popularity of some left leaning senators like Kamala Harris, yeah. Harris. same last name.
Yep.
We are seeing, I think, more progressives seeing an opening for themselves.
I think that's right. I mean, some of this is a holdover, a carryover from 2016. The Democratic Party continues to have, people make too much of so-called splits, but there continues to be contention in the party between what we might consider sort of the more mainstream part of the party, as was represented by Hillary Clinton, presumably, and the more left with the Bernie Sanders folks, you know, even past the 2016 election. So, and Delaware's not immune from that intra-party competition. And so we're seeing people challenged from the left who might not otherwise be challenged if they're thought to be too mainstream, or in some cases they've just been there too long, or whatever the other reasons might be.
It is interesting that Tom Carper now almost kind of faces what's, you know, he ran in, on the other side of, back when he ran against Bill Roth, when he originally won the seat, where Bill Roth had gotten to that point where maybe perhaps he had seen, some people see him as aging out. Now he's on the other side of that equation. It is an interesting thing to keep an eye on. I do want to wrap up on one thing locally, and that is the state's effort to legalize recreational marijuana hit a kind of odd bump in the road last week. The task force charged with examining it failed to have enough votes to release its report. Now, the task force co-chair, State Representative Helene Keeley, says she intends to make this report available anyway with the recommendations. And there may also be a new vote at some point on whether or not to release this. There may be some indications that they will find the votes to do so. And Keeley has also said that she feels she's approaching having the number of votes needed to pass this legislation. But my question to you guys is, does this hiccup and maybe the lack of consensus that the task force had tell us anything about the effort to try and get something like legalizing recreational marijuana passed here or anywhere else?
Well, I mean, just going back to a survey that we conducted at the CBC, just I think it was October of 2016, there's a majority of Delawareans favor legalizing marijuana. So I would imagine that number is probably higher now. So certainly public opinion can sway this.
Public opinion can, but the folks who are opposed to this, I think, feel more strongly than the folks who are in favor in terms of general public opinion. That's a really interesting aspect of public opinion. We can get overwhelming majorities for policies, but it doesn't matter if they aren't the things people actually vote on, right? And if the people who care intensely are on the other side, even as a minority, they can often drive things. And that may be what's going on here. I think the public is more or less sure, why not? But there are constituencies, there are people who are absolutely adamantly opposed. I don't know exactly what went on with this task force on the votes, but when I read about it, it seemed to be like strategic absences from the committee, since the requirement appears to be an absolute majority of the committee, not of those in attendance, right? So you can simply absent yourself and not have to vote one way or the other and still get the effect you want if you're opposed to moving forward.
Which brings us to the point that a lot of times when legislation like this in an election, you're particularly here in Delaware, people just tend to shy away from it. It's kind of a do-no-harm session, and you wonder if that may, in the end, be what trips up this legislation this time around, is that there's just not a lot of people who want to put their neck out on legislation like this heading into November.
Yeah, very well could be.
Well, I want to wrap up the podcast with what we want to do each and every time, which is give each of you a chance to kind of hit on something that we haven't hit on, whether it be something maybe a little more lighthearted or something that you maybe feel like you want to kind of make a prediction about, or just something that you have a personal interest in making sure that maybe we highlight that we might not normally highlight otherwise. And Lindsay, we'll start with you.
Sure. I was thinking about this, and I'm really fascinated by this new generation, particularly seeing what's been happening after the Parkland shootings. And in class last week, I was talking to my students about political socialization and sort of the historic moments that different generations identify as being the most historic event in their lives. And so we were kind of going through this, and they said, Pew Research, all the research that measures this, September 11th for pretty much all generations is the number one event. But when you go down the list, it changes dramatically for the oldest folks, it's World War II. For baby boomers, it's JFK. It's the Vietnam War. What I thought was interesting for Gen Xers, not far down the list, was the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I got to thinking about this, and again, having come from that generation, there was a sense of positive national pride and sort of global connectedness that I recall feeling. Again, I was a kid, but this was just after Hands Across America and We Are the World. You had Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie. Like, it was exciting. And when I was talking to my students from this generation, none of them could cite a positive event as being a historic moment in there. I mean, not even the Obama election. It was all shootings. A lot of them mentioned the Boston Marathon, having had friends or family near there. And I asked a student, one student raised his hand. He said, "Well, I think I've got one." He said, "When that plane landed in the Hudson River, that was pretty cool." So I think I'm just kind of fascinated right now about generational differences and what this generation that I might call a mass shooting generation, this incoming generation of young people, what for them is going to be historic. Is it going to be a single mass shooting, or is it just mass shootings broadly? So that's my fascination for the week, is just looking at generational differences and how that might impact support for these things like stricter gun laws.
I was trying to think if I had anything lighthearted, and following up on what Lindsay just said, it's hard. And it is actually hard. I think we're in a very difficult time, and it really doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum. It just feels like a very difficult time. And some of that, I think, is that it seems so hard to have any sense of control over our own lives. Again, no matter where you are on the spectrum, and frankly, no matter how well you're doing, it seems very hard. I'm old enough that I remember before email, right, before it took over my life, when I had to actually call people on the phone and hoped I could leave a message so I could move on to the next thing, and not expect to hear back, right? Or I'd had to put things in the U.S. mail. And the pace was just much more manageable, right? Just something we could control. So I hate to be depressing, but I'm just coming off of that at the moment with just too many things going on that just feel really out of control. You know, we just saw there was just an election in Italy, and again, we see the rise of the far right. We see right-wing populist parties doing well. I just spent a day and a half in Istanbul in support of an academic there who is being tried for having signed a petition calling for peace with the Kurds. And she's one of 1,100 academics who have signed this. People have lost their jobs. They're being suppressed and purged and all the rest of this. And this is a country that not very long ago was on the path to democracy. So I hate to say it's a depressing world out there, but it is right now. Maybe the next time we all get together, we'll have something a little better to say.
All right, you know what? Maybe we need to all join in. We are the world.
Lindsay's generation.
We're optimists.
That was a portion of the first episode of the Midterm Matters podcast, produced in conjunction with the UD Center for Political Communication and featuring CPC's Associate Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, and Dr. David Redlosk, Chair of the UD Political Science and International Relations Department. You can hear the entire Midterm Matters podcast right now at DelawarePublic.org and learn more about the Center for Political Communication's Midterm Matters National Agenda Series at its website, cpc.udel.edu. And the Green continues with our latest arts playlist, where we meet this year's winner of Delaware's Poetry Out Loud contest, right after a check of the latest local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware has a new Poetry Out Loud state champion. The 2018 contest winner is 15-year-old Sam McGarvey, a sophomore from Tall Oaks Classical School. He emerged from a competitive field of 12 Delaware High School students to earn the title at the state finals in Dover last month. McGarvey's final poem, I Remember, I Remember by Thomas Hood, earned him high marks with the judges. And in this week's arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele caught up with McGarvey to talk about his victory and hear his winning poem.
All right, Sam, how excited are you about heading to D.C. to represent Delaware in the 2018 Poetry Out Loud National Finals?
Oh, man, it's I'm super, super excited. It's such an incredible honor to be able to represent Delaware and just like even having such great competition in the semifinals and the finals, to come out as the person to represent Delaware, I mean, it's just an incredible feeling.
Take us back a little bit. For people that don't know you or people who want to get to know you, who is Sam McGarvey? What are you all about?
Well, obviously, whenever I perform, I want to perform to the best of my ability and to the glory of God, and that's what I've been doing all my life. I've always an actor, I would say, ever since I came out of the womb. So just having like grown that over the last few years and then being able to do different performances with different groups of people and learning from so many different approaches to that, it's been crucial in my journey.
What got you into poetry? Why do you like poetry so much?
Well, I got into poetry. We had the Poetry Out Loud competition at our school, but even before that, there's a competition at our school called Fine Arts, where everyone in every class is required to memorize and perform a poem just as a part of our regular schoolwork. So then just having performed well in the past in that competition, it allowed me to further my love for poetry. And then when the opportunity came around to perform in Poetry Out Loud, it felt like the next step.
You're a very bright young man. How old are you?
I am 15. I will be 16 next month.
And just letting everybody know, you are a sophomore that attends Tall Oaks Classical School. Do you want to read some of your poetry? Are you prepared to do that?
Sure. I don't have any on hand right now, but I could recite something that I did for Poetry Out Loud.
Yes, do that for us.
So this is the second poem that I did for Poetry Out Loud, and that is Very Large Moth by Craig Arnold. After DHL, your first thought? When the light snaps on and the black wings clatter about the kitchen, is a bat. The clear part of your mind considers rabies. The other part does not consider, knows only to startle and cower away from the slap of its wings, though it is soon clearly not a bat, but a moth. And harmless. Still you are shy of it. It clings to the hood of the stove, not black, but brown. Its orange eyes sparkle like televisions. Its leg joints are large enough to count. How could you kill it? Where would you hide the body? A creature so solid must have room for a soul. And if this is so, why not in a creature half its size or half its size again, and so on down to the ants? Clearly, it must be saved. Caught in a shopping bag and rushed to the front door, afraid to crush it, feeling the plastic rattle, loosened into the night air, it batters the porch light, throwing fitful shadows around the landing. That was a really big moth, is all you can say to the doorman, who has watched your whole performance with a smile. The half compassion and half horror we feel for the creatures we want not to hurt and prefer not to touch.
That was very good. Congratulations on that. That was not the poem that got you into the national finals for the 2018 Poetry Out Loud. What was that poem entitled that got you into the national finals, Sam?
That was I Remember, I Remember by Thomas Hood.
Why do you think that poem propelled you into the finals?
Now, back in the school competition, I did that as my second poem. So I also had that as my final poem, just like I did in the finals. And I would say it speaks to a lot of people. It's very relatable, though it is a bit bleak. It is very relatable in the transition from childhood to adulthood, and I think a lot of people can resonate with that.
All right, now for your winning presentation, Sam, you're going to receive $200 and an all-expense-paid trip to D.C. with a chaperone. You're going to be competing at the national championship on April 23rd through the 25th. Do you know what to expect yet?
I've been meeting with some Poetry Out Loud some of the leaders and the officiators, and also me and meeting with Cecilia Erigueta, last year's champion. We became pretty good friends last year, so to be able to reconnect with her was really nice, and she's been able to help me to kind of understand what is to come.
Just want to let everybody know that the Poetry Out Loud State Competition is sponsored by the Delaware Division of the Arts. It's in partnership with the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation, and it's part of a national program that encourages high school students like Sam to learn about great poetry through memorization, performance, and competition. It sounds like you're not afraid of competition.
I enjoy challenge. I would say that, definitely. And obviously, whether I win or lose, ultimately, it's for the glory of God. And as long as I do my best, that's what really matters.
Hey, Sam, what is in Samuel McGarvey's future? Walk us down the road a few years. You're only 15. You've got the whole rest of your life to live. What's in your future, sir?
Well, We've been looking a little bit into colleges recently. I want to be able to pursue theater and performing arts, and I hope that one day I can make a career of that. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, again, I'm just in awe. Is there a short poem that you want to take us out with that you can recite?
I could, if you would like me to, I could do the I Remember, I Remember.
Yes, do that one for us. Take us out.
I Remember, I Remember by Thomas Hood. I remember the house where I was born, the little window where the sun came peeping in at morn. He never came a wink too soon, nor brought too long a day. But now, I often wish the night had borne my breath away. I remember the roses red and white, the violets and the lily cups, those flowers made of light. The lilacs where the robin built and where my brother set the laburnum on his birthday. The tree is living yet. I remember where I was used to swing and thought the air must rush as fresh to swallows on the wing. My spirit flew in feathers then that is so heavy now, and summer pools could hardly cool the fever on my brow. I remember the fir trees dark and high. I used to think their slender tops were close against the sky. It was a childish ignorance. But now, 'tis little joy to know I'm farther off from heaven than when I was a boy.
Thanks to Poetry Out Loud winner Sam McGarvey from Tall Oaks Classical School for joining us on Arts Playlist this week. And so you know, the first runner-up at the Poetry Out Loud competition was Dunya Ramadan from Newark Charter High School. And the second runner-up was Richard Matthews from Dover High School. And stay with us. We finish out The Green this week with a look at efforts locally to better understand the American eel population. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. They're slippery, slimy, and you can see right through many of them. This month, young American eels are popping up in Sussex County after making the long journey from the Sargasso Sea in the North Atlantic. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pikus tells us how the first state's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control is tracking these eels to inform a coastal-wide management plan.
Jordan Zimmerman and Chad Betts are standing shin-deep in water under a Sussex County bridge at the base of a dam. The two state fisheries scientists are pulling young American eels out of a fishing net.
So we get all the eels out, put them in a splitter box.
They split up the box into a couple of sections, which helps them estimate the number of eels.
We'll work them back down till we have a couple hundred here, and since today's a subsample day, we'll take these back to the office, work them up, and extrapolate from that number what our total number is.
Zimmerman says the number of eels they catch and their coloration can help determine the timing of their arrival to Delaware's coast. The more translucent they are, the more recently they've arrived. At this stage, they're called glass eels.
When we have a subsample with a high proportion of pigment stage one, which is almost translucent, then we know that's a new cohort moving in.
American eels are born in the Sargasso Sea. The larvae drift on ocean currents towards estuaries, where they transform into glass eels. Zimmerman says they're looking for freshwater habitats, and Sussex County is a perfect fit. They change into yellow eels and spend 3 to 10 years in freshwater before maturing into the silver stage. Then they migrate back to the Sargasso Sea.
All adult eels spawn in the Sargasso Sea. They spawn once and they die. So they make one contribution to the next generation and then they pass on.
Though scientists know a lot about the American eel life cycle, they still lack data on it. Delaware and other Atlantic states sample American eel as part of the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission's coastwide management plan for the species.
We do consider eel to be data poor. so we don't have a lot of data that kind of would feed a big model that would give us reference points, you know, is the stock overfished or is overfishing occurring?
Kristen Anstead is a stock assessment scientist with the commission. She says that's why Delaware's eel survey helps. To better manage the species, scientists want to know,
what is the status of the species? Where is it compared to historic levels? Where does it seem to be going? And how much do you need to leave to maintain that species? And how much can you take to support fishing communities and people who rely on that species?
So state scientists like Denrek's Jordan Zimmerman survey glass eels to predict changes to their population.
In theory, if we saw a crash of young of the year eels, it helps us understand what the status of the spawning population was at the time.
At a lab in Little Creek, Zimmerman anesthetizes a small sample of eels so he can get their weight, length, and color. He lines the eels up on a white square plate and weighs them. He measures their length in millimeters.
59, 56, 58, 59.
Then he puts them under a microscope to look at their pigment stage.
Let's take a look.
Whoa, that's awesome.
Yeah, translucent, you can actually see the blood flowing through.
The data helps Delaware and the commission track a species whose population has been considered depleted but stable at low levels. The commission says while past data indicates their numbers are stable, an assessment from 2017 still considers the stock to be depleted. But this could be a good year for eels in Delaware. Last year, the state saw about 300,000 eels over 27 sample days at the Sussex site. Just halfway through this year's sample, they've already seen 220,000, giving them hope the American eel is headed in the right direction locally. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie, for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengest, as well as Delaware Public Media's Katie Pikus and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us on The Green this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.